In the here and now, as seen by events really just about over a week ago and many other times before that, the enemy of America has its combatants on American soil. My next guest with his new book takes you back in time for, in many ways, a similar situation. He reveals the state of the strength of America's military, the politics that was in play, and the steps at many levels taken by the enemy, who in this case were the Japanese during World War II after the attack on Pearl Harbor. His book is Pentagon of the Pacific, How America Prepared for a West Coast Invasion. He is really the go-to person for military history and other elements of history, having written over 36 books on the topic, along with quite a few other projects. Bill Yenny, thanks for being here today, Bill.
My pleasure.
And it's Bill Yenny, YENNE.com, for West Coast Invasion, along with Bill's other very instructional, no matter how fanatical about history you think you are, educational books. And as a starting point, Bill, after the day after the Pearl Harbor attack, assess what America's military and defense assets were on the West Coast.
Well, it was rather pitiful. The Air Force had just a handful of interceptors based at, or I should say scattered, to various bases up and down the coast. The only coastal artillery guarded the entrances to harbors, and that left 99.9-something% of the 1,300 miles of coastline just wide open. And as far as army strength on the ground, there were a couple of understrength divisions, one at Fort Lewis, Washington, and another one at Fort Ord near Monterey, California. And the commander of American forces in California was General Joe Stilwell, who your history buff listeners will recall as the American commander in China during World War II, but he was at the time of Pearl Harbor, he was in California, and he confided in his diary, the Japanese could land anywhere, and after we run out of our pitiful small stocks of ammo, they could shoot us, and this is his quote, like pigs in a pen.
Was that state of affairs and lack of strength based upon a belief that distance was an asset from
Absolutely,
the enemy?
Absolutely, yes. And the strategic doctrine for the defense of the West Coast had that the U.S. Pacific Fleet, the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet, would be able to intercept and destroy any potential invasion before it reached the coast. And, of course, the morning after Pearl Harbor, the battleships of the Pacific Fleet were on the bottom of Pearl Harbor, and every one of them was put out of action. Some were brought back into action relatively soon, but the morning after, they were all out of action, and the carriers were scattered at sea, and the cruiser strength on the West Coast was minimal. There was one battleship on the West Coast. It was undergoing repairs. There was no Pacific Fleet.
So Bill Yenny, whose new book, Pentagon of the Pacific, How America Prepared for West Coast Invasion. Bill Yenny, YENNE.com, is Bill's website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. You give, at the very early stage of your book, attention to General John DeWitt. Talk about who he was and what he meant and what he was up against.
Well, General John DeWitt was he was the commander of the Western Defense Command. In other words, he was the guy in charge of defending that 1,300-mile coastline and with minimal assets. And the morning after, when he might have gone before the people of the Pacific Coast and spoken as Churchill did in a similar situation when England was threatened with land invasion from by the Germans, Churchill had said, "We'll meet them at the beaches, and we have nothing to get to give them but blood, sweat, and tears, and we will stand and defend." And he inspired his people. Instead, DeWitt panicked. I mean, in the vernacular of today, he fr- freaked out. He went before the Defense Council in San Francisco and screamed that Japanese were here last night. They were overhead. I heard them in the sky, and they could have bombed us, but they didn't, and they're likely to do it tonight. And if you don't believe me, you're crazy, and you must react as I do with fear and panic. And he didn't say fear and panic, but it carried in his voice. And instead of inspiring his people, he frightened his people, and that fear evolved into panic, and the West Coast was scared.
Today we always talk about the calamity and the consequences when military meets politics. Was there any similar type of collision then, and were there consequences from that collision?
Well, the collision then was I guess more of a gathering of snow in a snowball. The politicians heard this uncertainty, this shaky voice instilling fear, and they began to worry. And one of the things that they worried about was potential sabotage by Japanese Americans, which I should hasten to add was absolutely unfounded. There were no sabotage conspiracies ever found. In fact, the Japanese-American perspective on the whole thing was exactly the opposite. They were very, very much, for the most part, patriotic. But people looked at that, and they looked at potential sabotage, and DeWitt did nothing to calm their fears, and people began to worry, and as people began to worry, politicians see an opportunity to jump on that, and we had all of the West Coast governors, Oregon, Washington, California, all of them jumped on this. Men like Leland Ford down in Southern California, or Mon Walgren, Senator Mon Walgren up in Washington State, began clamoring for some action to be taken against the Japanese, restrict them from here, forbid them from there. Eventually that snowballed into the calls for internment, and it was the shrill voice of the politicians that did that. And I should point out one of the strongest voices for Japanese internment was California's Attorney General, Mr. Earl Warren, who later reinvented himself as a champion of civil rights. But during World War II, he was very much not that. And in fact, he won the governorship in California in 1942 on a platform of being tough on Japanese Americans. And with all of that, President Franklin Roosevelt, who was a good listener of politician, listener to politicians, and a good understander of the political mood, he signed Executive Order 9066 in February of 42, which gave DeWitt the power, should he so choose, and he did so choose, to round up all the Japanese and put them in camps.
And Bill writes extensively about it's called the fifth column as far as the theory or conspiracy theory, depending on your viewpoint, as far as what was the potential given the aftermath of the attacks. We have just about a couple of minutes left here. Realistically, could the Japanese have made advances into America? Because certainly the stated intent was there with some of the quotes that you have in Panic on the Pacific. They had the intent, and by doing what they did to Pearl Harbor, it showed that distance was not an issue to them.
Yeah, the potential was definitely there. What they did do was launch a submarine campaign against the West Coast, which I describe in detail in the book. And they, as far as a direct invasion, they could have done that. The potential was there. They had
certainly the layouts and the logistics of some of the key cities would have made it literally a straight line.
Yeah, it would have been easy to get ashore. The coastal artillery guarded the harbors, but you could move 3 or 4 miles down the coast and find a nice beach to land, which was completely uncovered by coastal artillery fire. And there were a number of beaches, and I go into this in great detail in the book, potential scenarios from Aberdeen, Washington to San Onofre, California.
It is a book that, you know, when history is overlooked or buried, that is total disrespect of history. And what Bill does with Pentagon, the Pacific, how America prepared for a West Coast invasion, he brings these parts of history back to the forefront. And history is an eternal lesson, because you can realize and learn about our todays through our yesterdays. And I think Pentagon, the Pacific, how America prepared for a West Coast invasion holds lessons for todays, as well as truth, facts, and those who deserve honor and respect, and those who deserve the opposite as well, as the stories unfold, are worthy of receiving. Bill Yenny, YENNE.com is Bill's website. And Bill, you continue your tradition of writing educational, informational, as well as, strange word to include in this, but entertaining books, because you need to attract a reader to teach the reader, and you hit all cylinders on that. Thanks for doing that, for being here today.
Well, thank you, sir.